Good afternoon, everybody, or good evening, depending on where you are. I'm lifting a glass as a toast to Laurie R. King and her new Mary Russell Sherlock Holmes novel, Castle Shay, which we are launching here today. Very exciting. It actually publishes on Tuesday, but Laurie and I have been together a long time, and we have a history of doing this early. And the other good part about doing this together and doing it on Zoom is that we can show you some photos, because this book was written on a trip that Laurie joined with my family. And we went from Bucharest in Romania to the Black Sea, and then all the way up to Budapest on a river cruise. And Riviera Gold, which came out last year, was written by Laurie then hiving off to Monte Carlo. My husband and I went off to the Frankfurt Book Fair. So it's a little weird for me, because in my world, this book should have come first, but you were committed to Monte Carlo, weren't you?
Yeah. So I got two books and a short story out of that one trip. So yeah.
That's true. That was wonderful. And it's you know, in the chronology of the Russell Holmes books, it has been fluid, would be the word I'd use to describe it. It certainly has not always been chronological, but in this case, you've written kind of a trilogy, in the sense that Island of the Mad then became Riviera Gold, and now it's Castle Shade. Yep. And Castle Shade is in 1925. So I'm trying to remember, was Island of the Mad also in 25, or were you a year before?
Because it's not a good idea to stretch out the stories too much when one of your main characters is getting on in years, you kind of figure, let's keep them moving really quick. So let's see. The one set in Fez, which is called Garment of Shadows, ends in January 1925. And after that, all the books are pretty much back to back, although there's a gap in there because they go to Istanbul. Because I haven't been to Istanbul yet, you can't figure out that story. So, you know, at some point that gap will fill. But they then get back from Istanbul and meet the woman who that they met the year before in Japan. So that's when you sort of, and then they have the murder of Mary Russell, that when that case finishes, and then you have Island of the Mad and the rest of it. So it's
it all fits together, and you know, the new reader will be able to experience it differently. Maybe you can arrange them in chronological order. Interestingly enough, Laurie has written more than one book while traveling with me, because one of them takes place in Japan, and we had a wonderful trip to Japan where Laurie was the chauffeur, and we got thoroughly lost more than once. With great results, I might add. It was a lot of fun. But we left ourselves over to professional transportation while Laurie was researching Riviera Gold and Castle Shade. So Laurie, since we did go to Transylvania and we were able to actually see the locations in this book in person, why don't we take a look at them? You have prepared a little slideshow. And if Pat can put it on the screen, you should tell people where they are. Once they've got the visuals, then we can talk about the book.
Oh, well, some of these take some explanation, and some of them are not my photographs, they're Barbara's. But this is a this is a 3D puzzle that my grandsons and I built. It is actually, you know, you see these things that you you wonder how accurate they are, but to my astonishment, this one is extremely accurate. I mean, aside from the fact that they threw up their hands at what to do in the courtyard, the rest of it is just, I mean, it's remarkably accurate. So that's Braun Castle. And you can see under where it says Laurie there, you can see the steps going up, that there's a photograph in that the slideshow starts with all these people marching up the steps. And then the open courtyard there has pictures, which you'll see. And the kind of round building was the queen's quarters. She had quarters there. And the rest of it, there you go. So that's the part of Romania in the Carpathians that it's located in, and that's
right. And we drove up because we were a bit of a group from Bucharest up into the Carpathians, and it's a interesting mountain range. It's still remarkably wild in spots, and there are rumors, you know, or probably not rumors, but actual bears and wolves. Lots of hunting in this area. But what really struck us as bizarre, at least it struck me as bizarre, that in some of the long valleys as we passed along, and they're under the communist reign of Ceausescu, they had built bizarre factories that were quite long, quite large, and apparently didn't manufacture anything that anybody could sell. And now they're in ruins, but it's difficult to know how to dismantle them. So you have this wild background, and then you'll have, you know, a very, what would you say, Lori, 1980s or something kind of, yeah. You know.
Well, Ceausescu was trying to get people up into the mountains. He finished in the late 70s, but, you know, so the 50s and 60s, you had him really making an effort to move people out of the cities and into these perfectly remote valleys. And as you say, we never could figure out what these things were supposed to be manufacturing. I mean, they were on a river, but it was not a river that was navigable, so you couldn't ship stuff. And it didn't seem to have any power attached to it. I mean, it wasn't that it was dammed up and so that's where the power was. It was just this bizarre small town, and there'd be this, I mean, the factory itself would be larger than the town.
And it looked like a snake, you know, going up the valley, really ugly. So I'm hoping that Romania will figure out some way to remove them, you know, and restore the countryside to the way it was, because there's really no useful purpose that these structures envision. You know, I've lost track of Ceausescu, Lori. When did they actually take him out and finally shoot him?
I can't
remember. Hang him, whichever it was.
It was the 70s or 80s.
Was it? I know it was a terrible time for Romania. They've truly struggled to go on. All right, next picture.
And again, that's the village and the hills behind it.
Next photo. Aha, you can see that Romania is not perhaps as fully modernized as you might think, but in a lot of ways the landscape works better with the old-fashioned horse and cart. I'm trying to remember, Lori, didn't we go to some village where they talked about the fact that they had bought these shiny you know, modern conveyances and all, and they didn't work, so the villagers went back to the horse and cart?
It was part of the business of applying for status in the common market. And the EU said, well, you can't be in the common market and farm with horses. You got to have tractors. Here, we'll give you some tractors. So they gave them all this equipment. And of course, the tractors and things lasted 10 years. And then because they were all modern, you can't repair them. You have to replace pieces of them. And, you know, there's software and the rest of it, which so your local mechanic can't fix them. So off they parked the tractors in back of the barn and got at the horses again, except now 10 years had gone by. So then the EU said to them, look, sustainable agriculture. So, yeah. And the Romanian said, okay.
Well, that's a nice reminder of, it hasn't been that long since all of this happened. Okay, next photo. So I can remember, because this is my photo, the Castle Brand, which you're about to go visit, is on a rocky promontory that just sort of sticks up like an old cone from a volcano or something. And it's a fairly steep path. So this is on the path looking down at some of the property around the castle. It's very wooded.
That there is the village itself is just behind it on that side. The pass is up on the other side of the castle. But that there, I believe, was the tea house that the queen built. And at a certain point, although I don't believe you can go into it. The well, castle well, was converted into a single person or two person elevator because the queen was having problems, you know, hiking up and down the hill. So they replaced the well with water from elsewhere, and they just used the shaft to drop you down to the base of the hill and then dug a hole. So she would take the elevator down and walk into the garden. And so she didn't have to hike up and down the hill.
I love it. Right. Well, I mean, that's sort of a, you know, like a folly or Marie Antoinette's MO where she had sheep. This is a cross that you pass on the way. You can see the rock. This is part of the base of the castle. I don't remember, Lori, what the cross signifies. Do you?
I think it's outside the little shrine that used to hold her heart. Her heart is, I think her heart may have been taken off to the homes that she had on the Black Sea, or it may have been brought back. I don't remember, but that they had a little chapel that they tucked in underneath the side of the hill.
And she converted to Orthodox, right? So I think that, isn't that an Orthodox cross?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. Okay, next photo. Aha. All right, Lori, you can describe this.
Well, that again, I think that actually may be part of Brasov rather than Bran. But again, I think it's there to show the hills, because they're really an impressive bunch. The Carpathians are just an impressive bunch of hills.
Yep.
Okay. And this one is looking down the other side of the castle from the top. And that's in the background, you can't really see it very well, but that was the customs house. There's a small river that you can kind of see down there, and that goes up towards the hills and it leads up to Bran Pass itself. The reason that this castle is there is that it was guarding the pass between Transylvania and Wallachia. And that was the customs house. And the queen made this area. I think she has a big set of greenhouses there, then her private garden and the rest of it. So it's the other half of the village.
Okay, next photo. Aha, this is the entrance to the castle. If you survived the hike up the hill, which really is extremely steep, you can see that it's a pretty narrow entrance. And I might add, for those of you who wonder, that much of touring Europe is not ADA compliant. You know, if you can't climb up to the castle, you just don't get to visit it.
No. There's no handicap access at all. No. But this picture is also interesting because it shows over on the right-hand side, it shows what looks like a stone wall. That actually is what you call living rock. That's a cliff that the castle is built on top of. And so that when you look at the pictures of Bran Castle from various sides, sometimes it's got this great slab of rock and the sheer walls rise up from it. And that's a little section of it there.
Why are we looking at Bran Castle, you may ask, those of you watching this? And the answer is that this book largely takes place inside Bran Castle, but there are a few other things we can tell you about it as we move along. Next photo. Aha, there's the courtyard from ground level, essentially. Is that the well, Lori? It looks like the well.
That's the well. I mean, there's no water in it now, and I would guess that the elevator has been plugged up, but that's the well. The little section of flat place there, there's not much more to it than you see there. And the queen's quarters is the round wall to the left there.
And there are galleries, as you can see. It looks sort of like Tudor architecture, but there are galleries that you can walk around the sides of the courtyard. And there, that was my photo. And I remember, and I'm not sure what the red thing is, whether it's holding it all together or whether it's some sort of communication thing, but
Think we're holding the section together.
But now you're looking down into the courtyard. This is a very small castle. I mean, it's not, you know, because it's perched up there on top of this rock, And I'm always impressed that they, that, you know, I've been to Mont Saint-Michel and some really serious castles on top of rocks, and I'm always astonished that they managed to build them. I mean, without modern equipment and so forth, it's pretty much, it's awesome, yeah. Let me say. Right, okay, next photo.
And that's the top of the Queen's quarters. She had round rooms, so.
Yeah. And the next one? Well, Mother looked down into the courtyard from yet another spot. And as you can see, there's some hardy plant life that has managed to find a foothold somewhere inside. And
I was interested to see that even in the 20s, there was a big ivy growing there. I mean, you can, there's photographs of the Queen and her daughters and sons around there.
It's impressive. Now there is, well, that's certainly Marie and her crown in the middle. And you referenced the crown. One of the nice things about Castle Shade is that Laurie does give you some real historical background in this, because as with many of the Russell and Holmes, they're real historical people. That's a dumb sit. Let me try it again. They're real people in the books that are fun to write about. Is that Marie or is that Ileana in her, because she ended up as a mother superior?
Well, I'm sure that the two on the right are, and I think that the other one is too. I think they're all three Queen Marie.
Are they?
Most ungodly crown. I mean, how much could that thing weigh?
It looks really heavy. We saw it. I have a photo of it that we took in the museum in Bucharest. I suspect that the one on the right is a war uniform, you know, during the First World War, because she probably did nursing duty or something of the sort.
Yes, she did a lot of nursing.
Yeah. And this is a wonderful story. I took this photo. This is something that Marie presented or had sent to Buckingham Palace. Wasn't that it, Laurie? It was a presentation thing.
I wasn't sure. I wasn't in on that story. So I put it in, but I wasn't sure myself.
I think I took it to nag you into to writing this book. And I'm pretty sure that inside it, there is a gift that she sent to the British royal family. And one of the things we'll talk about is Marie's choice of husband, because in point of fact, she could have accepted a proposal from the prince who became George V, who married Queen Mary. But he could have married Marie instead. And I feel like I'm really surprised at her choice. We can talk about why it is she elected to marry into a relatively new dynasty in a place called Romania instead of marrying the heir to the British throne. I've always thought was a somewhat odd choice. But anyway, another photo? Or is that it?
No, there's a few more.
Ah, there's the crown. Okay. Which is also in the museum. And there are two of them. That's not the one in the photo that we mentioned, but there are two of the royal family's crowns in the museum in Bucharest. And that's one of them. And it looks, again, incredibly heavy. And that is a fashionable hat. Was this her clothing? It was in Bran Castle, wasn't it, Laura?
That looks to me like a man's hat, and certainly a man's uniform back there. So
okay.
I think it was a display of uniforms and weapons in the castle.
Okay, that makes sense. It does. I doubt if she was wearing a tasteful trouser suit. So you're right.
It looks remarkably like one of the paintings that shows Vlad Tepes. Has a thing like that. So it could be a traditional part of a uniform, I don't know.
Wallachian, I think it might be on his portrait, this in Budapest, because we will reveal to you, Bran Castle actually has nothing to do with Dracula or Vlad Tepes. It's a tourist hoax perpetrated, what was it? It was after World War II.
Ceausescu was after tourist dollars. When none of his money-making schemes came to fruition and the people were awfully hungry, he decided that what they needed to do was sell Romania to tourism. So among other things, they said, well, we got this castle up there. It's not doing anything. It's royal. And so obviously nobody lives there because the queen was kicked out. And so, so how about if we just take it over and we call it Dracula's castle?
So, right. And people flock to it. And the town of Brasov has become, you know, one of those tourist things where there's Dracula stuff everywhere. But and many people go to Bram Castle thinking they've actually gone to where Bram Stoker may have, you know, drawn inspiration for Dracula, or when Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, is really known.
Vlad Tepes was a local Wallachian ruler.
Yeah.
He may have had, certainly he had dealings with the city fathers in Brasov, which is only 20 miles away. And he may have been locked up for a short time in the cellars of Bram Castle. There's no records, but it's possible. But it's funny because you read Bram Stoker's Dracula, and his character sweeps in on this carriage, this horse-drawn carriage, into the courtyard of Bran, and the castle is all around him. Well, you saw the courtyard and you saw the steps, which are the only way up it. So ain't no horse getting in there.
No, that was, no, it was never really going to happen. But anyway, it has in fact become a tourist mecca, and we were among the very tourists who went there. So what can we say? I don't remember what this is.
It is just a funny little window. It was up sort of chest height, and it was obviously a combination of ventilation and spy window, but you could close it against the draft. So, but it was just such an unlikely window, and I'd never seen one quite like it before. So I stuck that in.
Got it. So you took a photo. Okay, next one.
Now, these, a few of these that I get a little mixed up. I think this is the Queen's, part of the Queen's room.
I think it is too.
There's several rooms that are hers, and I think that may be hers. One of the interesting things about Bram Castle I found was that, and they've tried to bring in a lot of stuff that was hers, or that is duplicates of photographs that they have from the time. So they tried to replicate more or less what it would have looked like during Marie's time, because she was given this castle in 1920 by the Brasov City Fathers, who had this castle that nobody could use for anything. And it was falling down, and they thought, well, this is one way of getting rid of it. So let's give it to Marie. And she fell in love with it. And she made a sort of glorified dollhouse. She had people who would, you know, come and visit her there. She loved the garden. She loved the people. You can see films on her. If you look it up on YouTube, there's various films of her in Bran, and the people are all, you know, flocking around her. And one of the things that I found so interesting about Bran is, compared with all of her other surroundings, both the main residence in Bucharest and the summer residence in Sanaa, which is not far away, were, and of course where she grew up, which were all castles, and including Windsor, which is her grandmother's castle, that is, she Queen Victoria. It was simple. It was stripped down. This is a fortress. It's not a castle built by aristocrats for their friends to visit them, and she obviously loved it for the purity of what it was. And I found it so unlikely, because she didn't cover the place in knickknacks and gewgaws. She didn't paint it. She didn't decorate it. She had very simple decorations, a lot of them religious. I mean, icons and crosses and the rest of it. And local crafts, weavings and embroideries and woodworking, which I found so unlikely considering who she was. But you know, that's why I said it at Bran.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And particularly since we went on from Bran to Sinai and visited the other castle, the sort of formal summer residence, and you describe it. How does it you describe it in the book? Because I love your description of it.
I don't remember. I mean, the whole thing is like this overstuffed Victorian sitting room.
Well, basically, that's what you say. Basically, the decor at the other castle. What's it called again, Paulo?
That's Pelish.
Pelish. The architecture and the decor at Pelish is so, you know, pure Victoriana. I have a lot of photos that I took of it because it was almost like William Morris had come to Transylvania or something. You know, it was really ornate. And Brayton, as you point out, is remarkably simple. I mean, the walls are you know, plaster and whitewash, not a lot of fancy furniture, few rugs thrown around on the floor. I do think that the big windows, which we'll get to, Pat, can you show us the next photo? If we kept the one of her sitting room up on the top, you can see that's another bedroom, but we'll get the one. The windows clearly are modern because they're very large and let a lot of light in, and they're up on the top in her quarters. So
keep going, Pat.
Yeah, you can move on there.
This is various dining rooms and so forth. And
yeah.
And this is the men's gaming room.
But, you can see with the places in the table where they could keep their chips or coins or whatever they wanted to. And that's a fairly ornate piece there on the left, but one of the few. Mm-hmm. Another one, Pat?
And there's a couple here of the traditional fireplaces that, you know, this is one in the Queen's quarters, and then there's one that's tiled.
Yep. Those are almost like, you know, the tile stoves that you see so often in Austria and Germany.
And this one, the tile next to it, traditionally the people would have slept on that because it gives warmth all night. And you know, it's the only warm place in the room.
Which is so Chinese. You know, if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, for example, they reconstructed one of the big Chinese bed platforms where they put the coals and everything inside, and then people slept on quilts on top of it in order to keep warm. Northern China is seriously cold, so, you know, it was a good idea. And this is very much the same thing. Next photo. Yeah, you can see what I mean about the windows and the furniture. I mean, it's, you know, almost like it could be
this
like anybody's living room.
This is called the music room that is mentioned several times in the book, with the sitting area for reading, the inglenook fireplace, and around the corner is the secret stairway.
Which comes into play, actually. Okay. Right. Just another photo of the fireplace and a bench to sit. That's actually an inglenook, you know?
Yeah, that one's an inglenook. And right next to the inglenook, that is the top. The little library nook, and that's the top of the stairway, the secret staircase.
Yep. Right. Okay, Pat, anything else? That's what I meant about the windows. I've always, you know, that sticks in my mind because look how much light flooded in.
But that's up on the third or fourth floor. So the walls are relatively narrow.
And that's it. Right. So that gives you a feeling for Bran Castle, which is, as I said, it's the scene of the crime, so to speak, or at least it's where most of the story takes place. So, Laurie, talk to us a bit about why you decided to write about Maria of Romania and take her to Bran.
Well, sometimes when I go someplace, I have a specific intention of writing a book there. And other times I think, hey, I'm on holiday, I don't have to take notes. And I end up going someplace like Fez or Bran, and I just fall in love with it. And I think, hey, I have an excuse to spend a year playing with this place. So this was one of the latter, one of those that I stumbled across, because I haven't been on many cruises and tours. I tend not to go in groups. So this was a new experience for me. And, you know, my brain was sort of baffled half the time because you'd be shuffled in these places and then here and there and the rest of it. And you think, I don't quite know where I am. But at one point we came through this room and here's this photograph of this woman, of Marie of Romania. And I thought, you know, she really looks like an interesting person. And this is, we had gone to this place and I had no background and I hadn't read anything up on, you know, anything that was there. And so I sort of started from scratch and read about Queen Marie, and I found her such an intriguing person, because it was a case of, I mean, obviously she's a granddaughter of Victoria and of the last Tsar of Russia.
No, the next to last czar.
Next to last, next to last. Her cousin is the last czar.
Right.
So the way that the world was organized, the world being Europe and Eastern Europe, politics and social life were all connected to this one family. And so when Marie, Princess Marie, came of age, she was a commodity that had to be spent carefully. So she wanted to marry her cousin, who was the second son and the second person in line to the throne. But her mother would not permit it because the Catholic Church would not permit marrying a first cousin. So they had to look around and they found this new family in Eastern Europe that needed a wife for their heir. And they paired her up with Ferdinand, a terrible match. The two of them had nothing in common. She was only 17 years old. And off she went to the far edges of nowhere. I mean, Romania is distant now, but in the 1880s, when she married, anyway, it might as well have been China for how close it felt to home. And she dutifully did her job, married the king, married the prince, became the queen, had children. And it wasn't until she was in her 30s that she started basically thinking for herself and saying, you know, I have opinions and I think I can get those opinions heard if I speak carefully. And one of the people who helped her figure out a way of doing that was this character that I introduced in a brief time in the book, Count Barbu Stubi, who was a traditional Romanian aristocrat, and great friends. Whether they were lovers or not, I don't know. And I don't know that it really matters that much. I think he was the father of her last two children, but does it matter long term? No. But I was so fascinated by this woman and how she created a life for herself and for her people, out of basically being in service. I mean, she was sort of handed over to this young man to be the official queen. I just found her fascinating.
Well, I do too. And her mother, her father was the second son. I mean, the second child, second son of Victoria, I'm trying to remember. Yeah. Was the Duke of Edinburgh, if I have it right. And so, you know, you would have thought that her mother would have been more interested in her marrying. Of course, George at that point was not yet the heir to the British throne. I think his older brother, the one who died, was still around. So it wasn't entirely clear that he was going to become King of England, but you know, to willfully send her daughter off, as you point out, to the ends of the earth, to a family they hardly knew, when she could have made a match that would have been much closer to home. I regard that very, you know, it seems to me that there was some.
Her mother also detested England. I mean, her mother had nothing but scorn for England. So I think that in a way, Romania was as close as she could get to Russia.
Well, okay, that is indeed true. What's interesting though, is that that part of Eastern Europe was pretty sparsely populated. And it lured a lot of Germans to go and live there, which was also true. We had a very interesting conversation with Mark Sullivan, who points out that there were many Germans that moved into I'm trying to remember which country it is, one of those K countries. And anyway, got caught in World War II between the Russians advancing and the Nazis, and you know, had to decide whether to flee east and take their shot on Russia or go west and risk the Nazis. But they were German families who had been settled for over a century. And it was also true in Romania and Bulgaria. So I bring that up because it was a difficult decision for them what to do during the two world wars. And mm-hmm. Romania, you know, was treading. The tendency was to side with the Austro-German Empire in the mm-hmm. First World War, but yeah. Prudence would dictate that for various reasons that they didn't. And Marie was really caught up in all that, you know, because there she was representing the Allies.
Romania was neutral for most, the first 2 years of the war, because the king wanted to join the German side.
Right.
And his ministers wanted to go with the English side. And so they just decided that the best way of doing it was just to be neutral. Well, the king died in 1914, and then everything started pushing against Ferdinand, who really didn't have an awful lot of backbone. And it wasn't until Marie sided with the prime minister and said, no, we have to go with England, and got the English side to agree that if they won the war, that Romania would get Transylvania back. So,
right. she was a real strategist. I mean, she was a very keen political strategist. And one of the reasons they were so grateful to her, Gary the Castle, and the whole bit, was because, in fact, she did succeed in bringing Transylvania back to Romania, and more or less, well, she didn't double the size of the country. I don't think it was quite that big.
Not much. No,
maybe it was. Right.
Close. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, she did an excellent job as queen. She died in what was it, 36 or 38? 38, wasn't it?
38, yeah.
So she just missed the Second World War when the whole thing would have, you know, come to a head again. And she did have some tragedy with her children. Her youngest child died as a baby, essentially, very young.
During the war.
And she had a difficult time with her oldest son, right? The one who eventually came back and King Carol. So, you know, it was a hard life, and I can see why Brian Castle was a real refuge for her. But anyway, we stray from the whole point of this, which is to talk about Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes. So we find them on a train, in a not very appealing train, making many stops in small towns, and Mary, with a terrible cold, being really pissed about the whole thing and pissed at Sherlock for smoking his pipe and trying to suffocate her. And they are on their way from Monte Carlo through devious routes to Romania. And so the question is, why?
Yeah, it was one of those things that I wrote the chapter of the train journey and had them, you know, end up in Brasov, and later realized that Dracula starts on a train as well. So I thought, okay, so I being the kind of writer I am, I never quite know what I'm doing until I get there. I sort of started, you know, raising it up a little bit about the parallels at the beginning. So she's off on this train, and Yeah, I think that it's one of those areas that when you write a series, you always have to try and decide how many pieces of baggage from previous books am I going to unpack on this one? How much does somebody who doesn't know the series feel lost if they come into it? Because, you know, when you're getting into 15, 16, 17 books, there's a lot of history there. And I hate it when you have to start out a book by saying, okay, this book is based on, and then this lengthy sort of repetition of what's gone before. And I don't know that that's usually necessary. I love the idea that somebody who doesn't know anything about Russell and Holmes could pick up a book. And as soon as you get under your belt, which is the first chapter, that this is a story about a young woman, Mary Russell, who seems to be married to Sherlock Holmes. And yes, it's the Sherlock Holmes. And you say, oh, okay. And go from there. At the same time, you've got all these issues that have accumulated in the past. And one of them is to do with his brother and how much the brother is going to control their lives. The other one is to do with Mrs. Hudson and the fact that Russell has lied to her husband about what she's done for Mrs. Hudson. And so there's all these kinds of emotional subtexts that are going on in there that you weave in and out of, you know, vampires and disappeared people and threats against young girls and all the rest of it. So it's I think why I write crime, and I'm sure why you read crime.
Well, I do think of these in their way as kind of a trilogy, in that the action, as we've already mentioned, goes from Venice with Island of the Mad to Monte Carlo with Riviera Gold, and now to Romania. What's interesting to me, I think, is that Mary Russell is often the instigator, or at least an enthusiast, in terms of them setting out on a quest. And in this one, she's really hating it. She has a terrible cult. She's on this awful train. She doesn't really know why they're going there. She doesn't even want to go there. And so, you know, she's being dragged along, so to speak. And, you know, that's a different approach than is often the case in the books. And I think that's realistic too. You know, even if they are, and you point out, there's one moment in there when they're talking about somebody and Holmes points out that he's now known, you know, he's been with Mary for 10 years, so he might have reacted differently before he had spent time with her. Now, if I remember right, was he like 55 when they met, something along those lines?
Yeah, his late 50s, yeah.
Right, so, and she was 15. So now she's in her middle 20s and he's in his middle 60s.
Yeah.
And that's still realistic, I think, for him to be, you know, doing stuff. He might've slowed down some, but he was not ever really a super action. I mean, he wasn't like an Avenger or something, you know, he was always cerebral, yeah. although quick to action when he needed to be strolling the moors or, you know, doing all this stuff. But, you know, you raise an interesting point, which is how far can you go in time past 1925 and still have him a credible adventurer?
Well, you don't really want her to be pushing him along in a bath chair.
No. No, but and you have gone backwards. I mean, you know, you can always do, you know, retreat to an earlier time and something. But that's why I say I like these three together, because of the progression. And it's a progression across Europe as well, you know, because they were together in Venice and then Mary went off to Monte Carlo. And then now here they are on this wretched train. And Mary Russell finally wakes up at the end of the chapter and says, you know, I'm not staying on this train. And she gets them to stop a better train that's going to be passing them and hauls them off into something where they can actually have a meal in a compartment. And she feels better about the whole thing. And eventually they get, as you say, to Romania and to Brasov. And we're pretty sure that Mycroft has probably got a hand in why Holmes has agreed to pose. Let me see if I remember this. He's posing as, what is it? A masquerading as an architectural consultant for, to explain his curiosity about the castle and why they are there at Bran Castle in the first place. That's a really nifty cover. Did you do that all by yourself?
Yes, I figured it, you know, it's easy to just kind of throw ideas out in front of people when you're an architectural consultant, and you just, they nod their heads and you say, oh yeah. So, but yeah, because they were doing work on the castle at this time, they were just starting extensive renovations in the castle. She had a, what was her, is he a Dutch? I think he was a Dutch architect who was hired to do the renovations. And they were about to start them in the fall of 1925. So Holmes is there as an architectural consultant, which just gives them a reason to be there, so.
So there appears to be, you know, the social media of the day, i.e. rumors and whatever else are swirling around Marie, and, you know, supernatural things maybe are happening. And so this being Transylvania, what are they? Are they Strigoi? Are they vampires? What's going on? Mycroft thinks that this may be an attempt to destabilize the regime. And so Holmes is there in a semi-official governmental capacity to determine what's really going on. Do we really have vampires here? Is this really some plan to, you know, take down the Romanian royal family? What's going on?
Yeah, because of course, you know, just the fact that Marie waltzes into the Paris peace talks and charms all of the negotiators into remembering that they had promised Transylvania to Romania. It doesn't mean that Transylvania is entirely happy with it, because as you say, there were a lot of Germans there. And the Germans had been there for centuries. One of the characters in the book is sort of, there you are, there's the Germans have been here ever since they came in. The possibility that you would be out to do another, in effect, Bolshevik revolution in Romania is not at all out of the picture. So yeah, the fact that this was a, for the most part, popular king and queen, certainly she was, the Romanian people adored her. The Transylvanian people, maybe not quite so much, because they didn't know her during the war. But the further you got from Bucharest, the more dubious people were about, you know, these people down in the other part of the country. So, yeah.
Right. So here we are. Is the question: are we really in a Stephen King thriller, or are we in a John le Carré spy story here? Which is it? I like this comment on a review. Russell and Holmes, this is from the Starred Library Journal review, which I thought was an excellent review. Russell and Holmes must solve the case before the perpetrator turns from threats to murder. King mixes a bit of real history with a case of misdirection and mayhem and goes back to basic detective principles, while her protagonists deal in their inimitable style with secretive locals, politics going awry, and trust issues that won't stay on the back burner. So we can be pretty sure that if Russell and Holmes are there, no matter how Stephen King-y and supernatural the possibility of vampires may be, that cold reason is going to be a significant part of the investigation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I had to make sure that when Random House was talking about the book to horror writers and stuff, that they didn't bill it too heavily as a book about Sherlock Holmes meets vampires,
right?
Because there are you know, there are certain concepts that are in the peasant mind that are very active. And I think the scene, you know, without giving away any spoilers, Russell is sitting one night at keeping watch in the village, and something very frightening happens. And the fact that even someone who is so incredibly rational and able to defend herself can feel the hair rise on the back of her neck is a very real thing. And especially in a part of the world and a time where you couldn't just switch on an electric light. I mean, there was no electricity even in the castle. There was nothing south of Brasov when it came to, you know, banishing the night. So, you know, the creepy factor of life in that kind of setting is very real.
Oh, it is. So basically we have a queen and her daughter, Princess Ileana, under threat, it would appear. And there Russell and Holmes there trying to figure out if it's a real threat or if it's a threat from, I like the word strigoi. I think that's a wonderful word. But anyway, are there really vampires in Transylvania? And you'll have to read it to find out. So I would like to say, because I also agree with this, that one of the reasons that we like Mary Russell in Sherlock Holmes, but Mary Russell, is she is a heroine with agency, such as Maisie Dobbs, Bess Crawford, or Franny Fisher, which I think is a great trio to bring in there. And it is fun to read historical fiction when you get real people and real events, but then you have fictional people and you do have a woman with agency at a time when women had less agency than you might imagine. And that's one reason Marie of Romania is so interesting, is that she did find agency, at least at the Paris Peace Conference, and, you know, do a wizard job. So Pat, we have questions from the audience or comments that you would like to introduce if I summon you up.
Hopefully I'm.
There you are.
There I am. Okay, great. All right. We've got some great Facebook questions, Lori. So one of the questions that the audience has for both you and Barbara is, when you go on vacation, are you writing your book as you're writing it or just doing research? What's your process when going on vacation to gather ideas?
Well, I gotta say, if it's a kind of vacation that Barbara goes on, you don't have time to sit and put words in a book. You keep moving, and if you're lucky, you can take notes and snap a few snapshots. But I have done, when I went to Lisbon, I spent 3 or 4 months in Lisbon, and there I was actually writing. I was working on Pirate King, and normally I don't do that. Normally I need to kind of get to know the place before I know how the book works there. But sometimes for something like that, yeah, I can do a certain amount of work there. But if you're traveling, especially if you're on a tour, I don't know that you really have a lot of time to sit and think about fiction.
Well, I can say, having made 2 research trips with Lori, although they weren't billed necessarily as research trips, that it was Lori and my husband and I, just the 3 of us, wandering around Japan on an itinerary that I sort of put together, but Lori contributed too, because my husband and I, Rob and I, had been to Japan before. And so we were on the lookout for a lot of things. And then we had some wonderful things happen to us that we could never have anticipated, which we won't go into here, but the Hotel Nara, for example, figures into all of that. But when we went with a group, because if you're on a river cruise, you're with a group. I mean, that's how cruises work, right? Lori specifically wanted to go to look at stuff. So we did the side trip, because it's not a river trip. We did the side trip to Transylvania, and we had to go with a small group of similarly interested people. So my role is to kind of point things out to Lori and take photographs and give her the elbow when I think there's something there that she ought to be covering. And then we can,
you know, I want to see this in the book.
We can talk about it later, but I have to say, Lori's imagination is all around. I don't have any, she doesn't even have a blueprint for the book she's going to write, so God knows I don't. So it's sort of like just a big grab bag of experience and stuff that we do. And then, you know, I'm always really surprised when I read the book and find out what she did with it. It's like, oh, okay. So anyway, we have a great time. We've been to France together. So far, though, you have not put them in the Dordogne, because we actually had a very interesting week together in the midst of the Icelandic volcano disruption in the middle of France. So that book is yet to come.
That book is yet to come.
Right. Okay, Pat, another question?
Alice Wright cracks me up. I'm sorry. I think her question is pretty loaded here, or a comment, actually. She says, Mycroft has become a big issue.
Yeah. Yes, I think people are you know, hoping for a major confrontation with Mycroft. And we avoided it because we've been outside England for three books. And there'll be another book, I think, before they get back to England. But at a certain point, I think everyone is anticipating that Russell and Mycroft Holmes are going to lock horns in a very serious way. And they're all really looking forward to it.
So Grace Yen has a good question for you. She says, how do you prepare for writing introspective, emotionally intense scenes? She's talking about, for instance, a cellar sequence in, and I apologize, MREG, I'm blanking on the title. When she realizes the truth about her family in
locked rooms. Yeah, I think that I'm a writer who, as you know, as Barbara says, I never quite know where I'm going with a book before I go there. And I think that to my mind, the rewrite is where the novel comes to life. So my first draft is, you know, 300 pages, 65,000 words kind of thing, of the machinery of the plot. And there will be certain scenes that may go into the final book almost unchanged, but most of them are in the first draft. They're in shorthand. It tells me what needs to get done and takes it on to the next scene. So when I have finished that and the machinery is turning and working and it comes out in the right place, I then look at the story that it actually tells and these human beings that are in it and how they would actually respond to a situation, not just how I need them to respond for the machine to work, but how, you know, what deeper issues does that wake up in this person? And sometimes it's too distracting to put that in. And so I just touch on it. But other times it's really necessary to get into it and really settle in and allow that character to deal with an issue, to profoundly feel it in a way that enriches the plot and the storyline. So it sort of has to do with where the balance of the story is when I'm working through and doing the rewrite. So, you know, my rewrite adds, you know, 100 pages to the final draft, and that is all in that kind of scene. All of it.
You had the same editor for a really long time, Lori, and I know that editorial process was a very important part of how how your books came out. As you point out, the first one is just the mechanics and so forth. And then, so there was a lot of editorial dialogue. Are you finding now that you're doing more of that yourself? I mean, you are the partner in the dialogue.
Yeah, I have a new editor. I've worked with her on this will be the third book, so that there's two books. And she's different, but it still seems to work. I mean, there's a lot more give and take in the early stages of the thing than there was before. And, but she's, I mean, what you're looking for in an editor is someone with a reader's eye that recognizes patterns and gaps. So that if you're not sure why this chapter isn't working, a good editor will be able to tell you why. They won't be able to tell you what to do about it. But I find that if the editor says, you know, this just isn't working here, and this is the problem, when I look at it, I will see what they're seeing and I will see how to fix it. So it's an interesting partnership, and I do not know how people do self-publishing without that kind of relationship.
So all in all, Lori, Catherine Van Boskirk would like to know, by the time you're done, how many drafts do you typically write?
Depends on what you mean by a draft. Some chapters will have been rewritten 20 times. Other chapters are nearly unchanged. The whole thing probably, generally speaking, I give the first go through, I will give to my editor, unless she's particularly pressed for time. If she's in the middle of 15 things and is off on holiday, I will say, I'll give it to you when you come back. But generally speaking, I'll give it to her at that point. And she lets me know what she likes, what she doesn't like, what she thinks that it would benefit from. And I will then go away for another 5 or 6 months and give her the more or less final. And then she'll send it back to me with certain changes. So if a draft is a thing that you show to your editor and get back again, there's probably 4 on most of the books.
Well, Lori, I've got to say that your fans just absolutely love your books, and they've written some of the nicest comments. Terry Miller just reread to prepare for this book, Island of the Mad Riviera Gold, and The Murder of Mary Russell to prepare for this one. A lot of people have been going back and rereading Mary Russell books for good comfort food. A lot of them feel that Sherlock Holmes is still viable as a 64-year-old gentleman. And it's still, even when you're 64, you can still be pretty spry. So we've had some great comments and some great conversations going on in the sidelines as well.
Yes. We have a Facebook group, the Beekeeper's Apprentices. And most of the people that you mentioned have are very, very active on that. I have problems keeping track of them, but they have
one moment on our trip as we are driving along. I can't remember from what point to what point we stop at what is a winery in order to, because they often organize that when you're with a tour group, is that they take you for local color to a local winery or something, but then part of the deal is that you can buy things there. But as it happened, this local winery also had a sideline in bees and honey, and they had some really nifty, they had a little bee museum, and they had all kinds of interesting hives and equipment and so forth. And so naturally, Lori disappeared into, you know, bee land. And I went along behind her.
I didn't realize they had this museum until we were all leaving. And I said, wait, wait. And But I disappear and there's a whole bus full of people waiting for Lori to get back from her beach.
I joined her, so because they might have left her, but they didn't really want to leave two of us. But anyway, you know, there's the serendipity thing that can come along and make it a lot of fun. We had a lot of those on our trip to Japan, which led to that book. So anyway, who knows what will be next, but I'm going to have serious conversation with Lori about why we haven't done anything about the Dordogne, which is, among other things, one of the great Paleolithic museums. It's the home of the Neanderthal and the Cro-Magnon, but there are also incredible medieval castles there and other stuff.
And so, the food is fabulous.
Well, yes, absolutely. Duck is a crucial. Duck and walnuts. There's actually a Route du Noir with walnuts. Yeah. And there's a lot of good stuff there. So, Lori, we're going to have a conversation about why Russell and Holmes have not so far made it to that part of France.
Well, maybe I have to go there for 4 months and actually write while I'm there, right?
Well, we've already done that. Surely you can remember it.
But we haven't been there in the fall. Remember? We decided we had to go back in the fall.
Oh, when the walnuts are out and the wine, right? And probably foie gras, which might be illegal in California and New York, but it's definitely not illegal in France. So there we go. Anyway, it's always fun to travel with Lori, and it's always fun to talk with Lori. So thank you for joining us for the book launch for Castle Shade. And I will say that we had hundreds of signed copies. And now I think we had, 10 or 12, Pat, when we started this.
So we might have less than that.
We may be gone by now, but in any case, thank you for supporting Lori, and thank you for supporting The Poison Pen, which is much appreciated. And let us wish you a wonderful rest of the evening. So thanks, Lori.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Thank you, Pat. And I will say, you know, anyone out there who has enjoyed this, make sure you buy a book from Poison Pen.
Doesn't have to be mine. Oh, and by the way, there will be a podcast available tomorrow, and the Facebook video will live forever. So you can share that with all of your friends. And by God, we're going to do this live next book. If I have to go to California and personally bring Lori back to the Poison Pen, I'm hoping that we will certainly have an opportunity, maybe even a visit, who knows, this winter or something in relation to something else. So you get a chance to see her, because you have so many local fans. I mean, I know you have an international audience and a national audience, but you have a serious audience here in Arizona that missed you. So it'd be great to have you back. Anyway, goodbye, everybody. Thank you for joining us. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.